Exodus chapter 26, and I'm going to have to turn around to read it because I didn't write it down, but let's begin there this morning reading from Exodus. It says, make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of finely twisted linen in blue, purple, and scarlet yarn with cherubim woven into them by a skilled worker. All the curtains are to be the same size, 28 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. Join 5 of the curtains together and do the same with the other 5. Make loops of blue material along the edge of the end curtain in one set and do the same with the end curtain of the other set. Make 50 loops on one curtain and 50 loops on the other curtain of the other set with the loops opposite each other. Then make 50 gold clasps and use them to fasten the curtains together so that the tabernacle is a unit. Make curtains of goat hair of the tent over the tabernacle, 11 altogether. All 11 curtains are to be the same size, 30 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. Join 5 of the curtains together into one set and the other 6 into another set. Fold the 6th curtain double at the front of the tent. Make 50 loops along the edge of the end curtain in one set and also along the edge of the end curtain on the other set. Then make 50 bronze clasps and put them in the loops to fasten the tent together as a unit. As for the additional length of the tent curtain, the half curtain that is left over is to hang down at the rear of the tabernacle. The tent curtain will be a cubit longer on both sides. What is left will hang over at the sides of the tabernacle so as to cover it. Make for the tent a covering of ram skin dyed red, and over that a covering of the other durable leather. Make upright frames of acacia wood for the tabernacle. Each frame is to be 10 cubits long and a cubit and a half wide, with 2 projections set parallel to each other. Make all the frames of the tabernacle in this way. Make 20 frames for the south side of the tabernacle, and make 40 silver bases to go underneath them. 2 bases for each frame, 1 under each projection. The other side, the north side of the tabernacle, make 20 frames and 40 silver bases, 2 under each frame. Make 6 frames for the far end, that is the west end of the tabernacle, and make 2 frames for the corners at the far end. At these 2 corners, they must be double from the bottom all the way to the top and fitted into a single ring. Both shall be like that so that there will be 8 frames and 16 silver bases, 2 under each frame. Also make crossbars of acacia wood, 5 for the frames, and 1 on each on one side of the tabernacle, 5 for those on the other side, and 5 for the frames on the west. At the far end of the other of the tabernacle, the center crossbars be extended from the end to end at the middle of the frames. Go ahead. I'm something of a geek. I like understanding how things work, okay? I come from a long and illustrious line of tinklers and fixers. Is that the right word? Tinkerers. Come from a long line of tinklers too. As a kid, I tore apart just about everything that I owned, and I at least attempted to put it back together. All right? I've built bicycles and computers. I've built cars and houses. I even helped to build this church building. All right? When I was in college, I bought a used set of encyclopedias that talked about how things worked. And I spent a good portion of one summer just reading up on refrigeration. Hello? I've impressed my kids personally with the application of Boyle's Law. Yeah. When I used to be a realtor, I even had to write those wonderful descriptions of houses that often leave you wondering if I'm really describing the place that you just looked at, right? When it comes to diving into technical language and descriptions, let's just say I've been to a few rodeos. Having said all that, there are just some things that really cry out for a picture or two. For instance, this recipe. Bear with me. Punch out rounds of cake and arrange in a sheet pan. Freeze for about 30 minutes. Scoop out the ice cream and place 1 mounded scoop on top of each cake round. Return to the freezer and freeze for 30 minutes or overnight. Prepare the meringue by first cooking the sugar and water together until the sugar reaches 240 degrees Fahrenheit. Whip the egg whites until soft peaks, and slowly pour the syrup in and whip until stiff peaks. Pipe the meringue in decorative swirls around each ice cream cake. The fluffier, the better. Return the cakes to the freezer and freeze for 1 hour or overnight. Just before serving, lightly torch the surfaces of the cakes with a kitchen torch. Transfer a cake to an oven-proof plate. Pour the kirsch into a small long-handled saucepan and heat over the stove for a few minutes just until the kirsch is hot. Carefully ignite the kirsch in the pot with a match. While the kirsch is flaming, drizzle over the cake and allow the liqueur to flame out into its own before enjoying. So, what did I just describe? Anybody? The winner is Baked Alaska Flambé. Now, is that picture more interesting and more understandable? Could you wrap your mind around possibly eating that? Of course, it's after the flame goes out. That's part of the presentation, is it looks cool and then it goes out. But then it's meringue with ice cream and cake inside of it, and it's wonderful. Anybody ever had? It's okay. It screams for a picture more than a description. Well, I hate it when the pictures of the food are not on the menus at restaurants. It just irritates me. Descriptions just don't do it for me when we're talking about food. So save us all a bunch of aggravation, restaurant owners. Go ahead and spend the extra money. Put the pictures on the menu. I know it'll make them thicker and bigger, and I get all that. But help us out here, all right? I feel better that I've got that off my chest now. I also start scratching my head the same way when reading through these descriptions about the tabernacle and all of the furnishings that go with it. In many ways, I'm sure that just about everyone in here was lost by about the third sentence in that reading from Exodus chapter 26. Amen? Yes. Yeah. So, how about some pictures to help a brother out? Got a couple here. So these are artist representations. Obviously, I don't think there was color photography back then, so this is all stuff that's either been hand-drawn or computer-generated, but somebody sat down and took the time to look at all the dimensions and the colors and how this and that, and they came up with something that they thought was kind of what was being described. So here you've got the whole courtyard with the tabernacle. You can see into it with the holy place and the holy of holies and the stuff out front. Next one. A little more detail, you get a little more idea of the better picture with the silver bases and all the stuff and the holy, much better representation, right? Give you a little bit better idea, let's keep going. Here's another interior view, just something, a little somebody else's rendition of it, keep going. So here you've got the priestly garment, talks about Aaron, the high priest, and all the ephod and the breastplate and all this stuff that went along with it, and some other descriptions of other stuff, keep going. Go back one for a second. You see the little guy down here. I'll give you some idea of the scale. So it was 5 cubits high, which is about 10 cubits high, which would be about 15 feet. So it'll give you some idea of the scale of it. Okay, go ahead. Again, this is another artist rendition. You've got the courtyard, a little bit different. Their rendition of the front curtain here and how that looked, and maybe how some stuff was staked down. Go ahead. Again, a little bit some more closer detail. Somebody's rendition of the difference in the skins, and there was camel hair. There was some other pelt that some translations have, like dolphins and sea cows and. I think the King James has badger. It's just something that we don't really know what it was, but that's what the outer thing was there. Go ahead. The altar. Thank you very much. Go ahead. And then the lavier or the basin. It would have been outside made out of bronze. Go ahead. Just an inside of the holy place. You've got the candlestick, the altar of incense, and the table of showbread. I think the next ones are just close-ups of those, table of showbread, candlestick, altar of incense, okay? And then you've got inside the Ark of the Covenant, and I think there's one more, another rendition of the Ark of the Covenant. So just some visuals to kind of, all that stuff from chapter 25 through chapter 31 is a description of this stuff. What does it look like? What was it made of? So hopefully, that brings you forward, just like the picture of the flambé. It just kind of says, oh, it makes so much more sense now than all of that technical readout of what it was. So now that we have a better handle on what this all looks like, next question is, what does it mean? That baked Alaska flambé looked like it meant delicious. That's what it looked like. So what about the tabernacle and all of its furnishings? Let's take a look and see some of the things that they mean. Number one, the tabernacle is a symbol of God dwelling with Israel. What did the Israelites see when they looked at the tabernacle so long ago? They saw a tent with two inner rooms and a yard outside. In the yard was the Israelite equivalent of a stove, namely a place the meat could be roasted on a fire. A tent means very little to us, but Israelites knew all about tents because they were living in tents. Then God told them to make a tent for him, a tent where God himself would dwell and meet with them. In chapter 25, verse 8, it says, God told them, then have them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell with them. His tent had rooms and a yard and a fireplace just like their own. Yet it was also much unlike their own. It was majestic, covered with gold and blue. It was beautiful because of the symmetry of the dimensions and the artistry of the construction. Do you see? God was saying that he was majestic and beautiful, but he would not simply remain in heaven and let Israel go its way. He would come down and be right with them. They were living in tents. He too would live in a tent, side by side with their tents. They were going to the promised land. He too would travel to the promised land as his tent was packed up by the Levites and moved to the next encampment. A special cloud of fire symbolizing God's presence was more intensive, miraculous form of the same reality. God would be among them, right with them. He was Emmanuel. The theme that God dwells with his people was fulfilled with the coming of Jesus Christ. In fact, the tabernacle foreshadowed the fact that Christ would become incarnate and dwell among us. John 1:14 says, the word became flesh and lived for a while. He tabernacled with us. We have seen the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. The tabernacle expresses another side of the character of God, namely that he is holy and inaccessible. The altar, several coverings, and two sets of curtains bar the way into his presence. No one can enter into the outer room, the most holy place, into the inner room, the most holy place, except the high priest, and even then is only done once a year with a very special ceremony where he is protected from his sin and the accusation of the law by the blood that he brings in and sprinkles on the mercy seat. Death is threatened to transgressors of God's holiness. The second thing that the temple symbolizes, that it shows us, that it enlightens for us, is that it's a symbol of Jesus. The Old Testament tabernacle is full of meaning because it is a symbol of the Messiah and his salvation. The book of Hebrews gives much instruction concerning the tabernacle. From Hebrews chapter 9, beginning with verse 11, but when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are now already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not made with human hands, that is to say, that is not a part of this creation. He did not enter by the means of blood of goats and calves, but he entered the most holy place once for all by his own blood, thus obtaining eternal redemption. The blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they are outwardly clean. How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from the acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God? For this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, now that he has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins committed under the first covenant. The earthly tabernacle was a copy or a shadow of the true dwelling place of God in heaven. It showed what God was like and what was needed to deal with sin. In this way, it symbolized what the Messiah was to do for our salvation. We say that it foreshadowed the Messiah and his work. It's like a shadow of the Messiah cast backward in time into the New Testament or the Old Testament period. The shadow was always inferior. The shadow was always inferior to the reality. The earthly tabernacle was made of earthly things and could never equal the splendor or holiness of God in heaven. The earthly sacrifices of bulls and goats could never equal the blood of Christ, who cleansed us from sin forever. The shadow was not itself the reality, but a pointer to Christ, who was the reality. Israelites had genuine communion with God when they responded to what he was saying in the tabernacle. They trusted in the Messiah without knowing all the details of how fulfillment would finally come. And so they were saved and they received forgiveness even before the Messiah came. The animal sacrifices in themselves did not bring forgiveness, but Christ did as he met with them through the symbolism of the sacrifices. The third thing to note is that the tabernacle is a symbol of heaven. What ended up happening to the tabernacle? Well, after the years in the wilderness, the Israelites finally, through long struggles, they entered the promised land and they were able to settle down. But instead of living in tents, they built houses for themselves. Fittingly, King Solomon was commissioned by God to build a permanent house for God, the temple, which replaced the mobile tent-like tabernacle. The temple had the same basic arrangements as the tabernacle, two rooms and an outside courtyard, but each of the horizontal dimensions was doubled. As he dedicated the temple 480 years after the Exodus, he spoke of the earthly temple as a place where God had put his name. Solomon says in 1 Kings chapter 8, starting at verse 23, "Lord, the God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or in earth below. You who keep your covenant of love with your servants who continue wholeheartedly in your way. You have kept your promise to your servant David, my father. With your mouth you have promised, and with your hand you have fulfilled it, as it is today." Skipping down to verse 27. "But will God really dwell in earth? The heavens, even the highest heavens, cannot contain you. How much less this temple I have built? Give your attention to your servant's prayer and his plea for mercy, Lord my God. Hear the cry and the prayer that your servant is praying in your presence this day. May your eyes be open towards this temple night and day, this place of which you said, 'My name shall be there,' so that you will hear the prayer your servant prays towards this place. Hear the supplication of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray towards this place. Hear from heaven, your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive." Heaven is the true dwelling place of God and the place from which God hears. Thus, Solomon recognized that what we have learned from Hebrews, that the tabernacle and the temple were mere shadows of the heavenly things, the true realities. In Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5, it says, "The priests serve at a sanctuary that is a copy and shadow of what is in heaven. This is why Moses was warned when he was about to build the tabernacle. See to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." When we look at the tabernacle again, we see an unmistakable signs of the symbolism of heaven. The two cherubim by the ark are replicas of angelic heavenly beings guarding the throne of God. More figures of cherubim are woven into the veil that guards the way into the most holy place. Still more cherubim are woven into the 10 curtains that constitute the main material of the tent enclosing the two rooms. The Ten Commandments, the very words of God, are written on tablets that Moses received from the Mount, which is itself a symbolic replica of heaven. They are placed in the Ark of the Testimony, the most holy object in the entire tent. Thus, the tabernacle as a whole is a replica of heaven. When God came to dwell with the Israelites, he brings down to them in his wonderful condescension, a little replica of heaven. Revelation chapter 21, begin with verse 1. Says, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. He who is seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. Then he said, write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. For those who are victorious will inherit all this, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. Verse 22, I do not see a temple in the holy city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city does not need the sun or the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Each detail of the tabernacle is one part of a tantalizing visual poem suggesting a multitude of relationships all tied together in a single structure. It is fitting that the symbolism of the tabernacle should be multifaceted. After all, such is the character of Christ, who as one person contains in himself all the fullness of the deity, a manifold riches of wisdom and of love. So no matter how good you are, how bad you may be, at seeing the images behind the words describing the tabernacle, don't lose sight of the picture of God dwelling with his people, of the picture of Jesus' completion of God's redemptive work, or the picture of our ultimate home in heaven one day. I feel like I should take just a moment to kind of come down and put what I've written aside. Got an opportunity to do quite a bit of study on this week. And I must say that it's kind of overwhelming. If you just go and do a search on tabernacle, just type in tabernacle in Christ, some of the in-depth study that people have done to connect all of the greater symbolism of everything that's involved with all of the furnishings, all the dimensions, the colors, the materials used, it's just absolutely overwhelming. And I wouldn't say that maybe any of them are better than others. Some kind of connect. I get that. Others I read through and I thought, that guy sounds like he's in left field, but what do I know, right? the big thing for me, the big takeaway was that all of this God did on purpose. That if you look at the timeline from the time that the Israelites arrived in Egypt to the time of the exile, it says it was 430 years. From the time of the exile until the dedication of Solomon's temple, or at least the breaking the ground of Solomon's temple, was 480 years. So 910 years have passed from the time when the Israelites came to Egypt till they were settled in the promised land with houses, a temple for the Lord. Approximately another 1,000 years before Christ would come along and finally complete the promises that were made. And along through all of this, God has been very deliberate about how he has brought the people along step by step from where they were to where he needed them to be. And from that, I couldn't help but think of us, where God has brought us from over time. I've been here for quite a good portion of my life now, and I've seen incredible changes. Looking back, short term, it's kind of hard to see some changes, but when you look back in time, it's, wow, there's a lot of things that's changed. I look forward and I see, where's God taking us? Just like the Israelites, this picture of the tabernacle, and he's brought them to this place and time, and he's given them this revelation of himself, of where the plan is at right now. I wonder, where are we at this place and time in God's plan for us? Are we at the beginning somewhere? Are we early on? Are we 480 years later than we think, or 430 years sooner than we thought, or this is some 1,000 years that, you know, we're at the end? Really don't know. But I would like to challenge you this morning to maybe look at where do you want to be? Where do you want this community, this family, to be along this journey that God is leading us on? You know, there's things around us that say, hey, maybe there's something new is going to take place. Maybe there's excitement, there's new life, there's restoration, there's new hope. But those may just be fanciful things. I really don't know. But I would challenge us to say, as a body, let's decide that wherever God has got us on this journey right now, we're going to get on board with it. We're going to step up to the plate, take a good look at ourselves. Maybe we'll have to do some serious repenting. Maybe we'll have to do some serious forgiving. But I think it's time that we stop playing. As they say, time to put on our big boy pants, right? Time to get serious. Time to stop playing church. Or we can wander in the wilderness for another 40 years. I'm sure God will still love us. You know, one of the things that we got an opportunity to talk about in our small group, the incident of the crossing of the Red Sea. We looked at that a couple weeks ago. God told Moses, take the people to this certain spot. It's right here, and he described it, and it's right across from this one place, and I don't remember all the details about it. But that's where they went. And when they got there, and Pharaoh showed up with his chariots, they were stuck. They were trapped. And in that moment, God intervened and parted the waters. Now, the question that comes to my mind, when God told Moses, lead the people here, if Moses didn't lead them there, or they didn't follow, do we have the story of the parting of the Red Sea? If they weren't obedient to that point, to where by their obedience they were backed into a corner, there was nothing that they could do, and God had to step in and rescue them. We look at that today as a glowing example of God's miraculous intervention into his people. But what if they had ventured down the coast 5 miles? When the Egyptians showed up, God said, you can get out that way now. You don't need me to step in. It's cool. What I'm challenging you with is, are we going to be obedient to do what God calls us to do? And maybe, just maybe, in that moment when we do, God intervenes into our situation. God steps in and does something that people generations from now will be talking about. Because we had the faith, and we acted in obedience, and we put ourselves in a position where only God could rescue us. I hope that when you come across passages like this in Scripture, that it just frustrates you. You read through it and you go, dig deep. Go find somebody else that understands it better. Get some pictures. Do whatever you gotta do. But don't be satisfied with just, a distant taste of what God has in store for us. Step up and take a big bite. Get a whole armful. Go fall in. Because I just have this sneaking suspicion that God won't let us down. God won't let you down. Hebrews 11:6 for a long time has been, I would call it my life's verse, the one that I embrace. It says, those who come to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Grab that tiger by the tail and don't let go, because God won't let you down. He promises. If there's anything that we can do for you this morning, if we can pray with you, if we can pray for you, we can help you in your walk further with Christ, if you need to be baptized into him, take a first step in obedience, whatever your need is this morning, we would be glad to assist you in that, to be a privileged partner in helping you to understand things better, to know the ways of God, and to be obedient to the things that he asks of us. Whatever it is that you need this morning, we'll be happy to assist you. Come forward now as we stand and sing this song together.